and welcome to a special From the Rookery End. We're here to launch a fantastic new podcast series for Watford fans. Some of you might have picked it up way back in 2010. Enjoy the Game, written by Lionel Burney. It's a story of Watford Football Club, the story of the 80s, the story of Graham Taylor's first era here at Watford, the golden era for Watford Football Club. And it was a meteoric rise, as we all know, from the bottom of the fourth division, as it was in those days, to the top of the first division. A trip to Europe, a couple of FA Cup semi-finals, an FA Cup final. But this book is going to be, it's going to be a wonderful thing for people who lived this era and to relive it. Lionel spoke to over 40 people to write this book, many of the players, and of course Graham. Colin brings it to life just superbly as the narrator and doing all the voices of all the players in a such a respectful way. But also people who have never really heard the details of this era. They might know the facts, the figures, the important games, the 7-1 against Southampton, for example, but do they really know what it was like for the people who were there? And it was an era where there aren't many videos of the games from back then on YouTube, and there certainly aren't interviews with the players. And this is a great way to bring it all together. You'll hear later in the podcast the first chapter. And tomorrow morning, on Friday morning, Friday the 13th, you will be able to go and find your podcast, wherever you get your podcast from. You'll be able to find Enjoy the Game, the audiobook series. And from there, you'll be able to enjoy 26 chapters. So before you hear chapter one, let's have a quick chat to Lionel about the book and how he put it together. Why did you start writing this book then, Lionel? Because, you know, I get why it was an important era and an important time for Watford. But what was it that sparked you in 2008 you started?
Well, I actually started in 2009. I suppose the trigger for the idea was that I'd read that the club was arranging some kind of anniversary. I think they ended up having a dinner to mark the 25th anniversary of the FA Cup final, which was in 1984, of course. So in 2009, I think it was around May time, they got the players together with Graham Taylor and the coaching staff, and they had a reunion, which I think was attended by supporters. I've got a feeling it was, because I remember I was away working and couldn't go, but it just sparked something. I thought, that's kind of my era. That was when I first started going to watch Watford with my dad. My first game was in 1983, and so I kind of joined this fantastic journey midway through. And I suppose my entire support of Watford has been marked, I guess, by missing out on the kind of the beginning of the journey. It was really motivated by a desire to go and meet most of my childhood heroes. and I thought, well, why not piece together the story and try to tell it? I mean, I didn't try to tell it in a different way, because it hadn't been told at the time in one sort of complete collection. Obviously, Oliver Phillips of the Watford Observer had documented pretty much every moment of that incredible decade from 77 to 87. I kind of wanted to put it together in a book. I do remember talking to Ollie at some point saying, would you ever write that story as a book? And he kind of said, no, I don't think so. I'm a newspaper guy. I've done my books, kind of thing. And I suppose it was motivated by that a little bit. It was the book that I wanted to read. I wanted to hear the stories from the players and the management and actually sort of piece them all together as a kind of a, I guess the genre is kind of an oral history, isn't it? It's just sort of, you know, we hear the stories told by the people who were involved at the time. And one of the first things I realised was that everybody's memories of the same events differ slightly. And okay, my first kind of conflict was, you know, what do I do here? Do I leave out good material that might contradict somebody else's good anecdote? And I decided in the end that I would just, no, I'll put in the best material that I get from each of the people that I interview. So, yeah, I guess it was an 18-month process going around the country, interviewing all the players, tracking them down, which at the time there wasn't the kind of ex-players association. I think that was in its very early days. So some of the people were really off the radar.
Who was the hardest to find?
I think I was most satisfied when I got a number for Wilf Rostron and I rang him, told him what I was doing, and he was keen, because I'd been led to believe that he might not have wanted to talk about it, because he's the sort of person he said it when I went to visit him at his furniture warehouse in the northeast. He said he doesn't really live in the past. You know, his football career was behind him, and he was, you know, living his present day life.
I mean, you speak to everybody, literally everybody. And what I like about the, when I first read it, and now we're going to hear it as a podcast series, you know, the fact you do talk about all the major events, but you also sort of go into, you know, the individuals, and in certain people, certain groups get their sort of their chapter to sort of really shine through. Was there anyone when you spoke to, you know, you say Wilf, someone you wanted to find, was there someone who completely surprised you in terms of what they, how they spoke about their time at Watford?
Nigel Callaghan was one, you know, a very sensitive soul, really. And I could sort of understand perhaps why, in the grand scheme of things, such a talented player. I mean, Graham Taylor even said his, you know, his right foot was as good as Beckham's. But Nigel's career after he left Watford, you know, it sort of kind of bumped along and ended prematurely. He wasn't really cut out for the dressing room in a lot of ways, I think. You know, he found the life of a professional footballer in the 1980s quite challenging. And, you know, I went to see Nigel. I actually met him. He was visiting his mum in Stafford. And I just kind of saw someone who, and I'm not being unkind here at all, because I really warmed to him and we kept in touch for quite a while afterwards. But I kind of thought it was almost strange to think that this guy had played at the top level of English football. He'd played in an FA Cup final. He'd represented England under-21s. Well, until recently, the last England under-21 team to actually win something. And he just didn't strike me as a former professional footballer at all. The other surprises, I guess, Dave Bassett was quite a revelation, because one of the things about the story was I didn't want to just end it at the moment that Graham Taylor left. I wanted to kind of explore a little bit why it unravelled so quickly after he left, because I think the fairy tale and the kind of everybody's anecdotes about what Graham Taylor's methods were all about, in a way, it was almost too simple a story. It was really in the telling of the downfall after he'd left that you really gain, I personally gained a real understanding of just how much had gone into creating the success in the first place. And as a young, impressionable supporter in 1987, when Dave Bassett took over, I held him totally responsible for the destruction of my football team, you know, and that kind of childhood resentment hadn't worn off at all. And so I was expecting quite a combative conversation with Dave Bassett, and I can't honestly say I went into it, you know, without prejudice, I guess. But we had a cup of coffee and a little bite to eat at a hotel somewhere in Buckinghamshire, and I found him warm and engaging and honest. You know, he was very forthcoming about his own shortcomings and the mistakes that he made. He talked about some of the mistakes other people made as well. But I wasn't expecting that at all, really. I was kind of expecting him to put the case for the defence, and I didn't get that. And it kind of leaves the end of the book, kind of leaves a slightly different impression, because I think it's very easy to look at success in isolation and think everything's wonderful. You kind of have to zoom out a little bit and look at where they'd come from, and then where they went back to after Graham Taylor and all those fantastic players have moved on.
Yeah, because there's that thing with, I suppose, with Graham, you know, you worked with him on his book before he died, and, you know, you probably know him better than many people, having spoke to him so much. It really comes across in this book, though. Was this the first time you really sat down with him to look back on things?
It was, yeah. He had interviewed me for a job at Watford Football Club when he came back in the sort of towards the end of the 90s, and I got down to sort of, I don't know, the last two or three. I didn't get the job, and he rang me up. I went in typical Graham Taylor, you know. He rang me up to tell me that he wasn't giving me the job and explaining why. This was a job in the, I say the media team. There was no media team. It was to be the club's media person, a job that I wouldn't have been very good at. It, you know, I probably even knew that at the time. But he said, no, you should stick to what you're doing. Stick to journalism on that side of the fence. And that kind of always stuck in my mind. So when I contacted him about this project, initially he said he wouldn't talk to me until I'd done a good bulk of other interviews. I think he didn't want to just kind of give his time on a project that might not end up going somewhere. So he said, oh, look, come back to me when you've spoken to, I don't know, 15 or 20 people. If you're going to try and talk to 40 people, come back to me halfway through. I think it was partly motivated by his own desire to know what people had said as well, because he did ask me a lot, you know, what's Steve Sims said about this, or what's Luther said. And so I think that led to kind of deeper conversations, deeper interviews. And for Enjoy the Game, I went up to the Belfry, because he was living in the Midlands at the time, and we met at the Belfry, and we spent probably 2 or 3 hours together the first session, and then we did another couple of sessions on the phone. And without Enjoy the Game, there's absolutely no doubt I wouldn't have been in the position to do his autobiography when the time came. But yeah, listening to Graham talk about a period of time that was incredibly dear to him was, it really was a privilege. And as you know, Graham can talk for England, could talk for England. And there was a real relish in his storytelling, you know, and he was reliving some you know, very special times, and hearing about the people and the relationships, and also the things that he was reflecting on. Well, what was it, decades of experience, behind him, just reflecting on the sort of the young firebrand he was when he took over Watford, and that incredible journey that he and Elton John took the club on. It really was a fairy tale. And it wasn't like they didn't set out with a very clear goal in mind. I mean, the start of the book, sets out. They wanted to get to the First Division. They wanted to compete with the best clubs in the country, and they had a plan for doing it. And I think that's what makes it all the more remarkable, that they actually talked about it at the start. This is what we want to do, and this is how we're going to do it.
Yeah, the first chapter is Elton's dream, and it's almost like maybe that they didn't. They had a chat about what they wanted to do, and I think Elton surprised Graham, and Graham surprised Elton, and the two of them together did achieve things far quicker than they even thought they were gonna do things. We speak to all the main players, the backroom staff, actually they were the characters, and even the directors who made the decision to hire Graham originally, or not make the decision, almost pushed Elton a little bit to pick this young manager who they'd met through going to Lincoln and meeting all these young managers and these people from all across the league. Those characters were very interesting to speak to. Did you find this, for me to listen to, did you find it when you spoke to them?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, one of the directors, Muir Stratford, who remained involved with the club for many, many years as a director, but then as a supporter, absolutely Watford through and through. He was one of the people who cautioned Elton John. The story, for those who don't know, is that Elton had taken full control of the club in the Fourth Division, was on the lookout for a new manager, and had identified and, in fact, approached Bobby Moore, the ex-England World Cup winning captain. You would think, wow, what a fantastic appointment that would be. Really put Watford on the map very early. But Muir Stratford, Jeff Smith, Jim Harrowell, the directors at the time, they were not so sure. They wanted somebody who knew the fourth and third divisions inside out to get the journey off and running. And they did say to Elton, look, if you're going to put this sort of money into this venture, you want it to be in really safe hands. And they'd been very impressed with Graham Taylor when he'd been the Lincoln manager, when they'd run away with the Fourth Division title a couple of years before. And they, I think it says a lot about Elton's respect for the directors that he listened to them and followed their advice. And then when he met Graham Taylor, was equally convinced that he was the right man for the job. But Muir Stratford, just talking to somebody who had been there at the very beginning, inside the club when that decision was made, and to be able to talk about the kind of the, you know, the ambition, but also the doubts and the kind of the potential pitfalls. You know, everybody could have ended up with egg on their faces, couldn't they? Let's face it. I mean, I don't think there was any doubt that Elton John's commitment to the club, steering it up through the divisions, was anything other than total. But just having a dream and, you know, carrying that out, that required work and, you know, dedication and commitment, and the whole club kind of pulling together. And just hearing that there were some kind of, you know, frictions at the right at the very beginning, when it could have gone in a completely different direction, I think, again, it's one of those things that means that we can't take that decade for granted. You know, there were so many points along the way where it could have turned out slightly differently.
Yeah, it wasn't season after season after season. There were lots of hurdles to come over. And I suppose the way that Graham was running things and the support from Elton, they were sorted out, and Watford made it to the top division. But on the way, you know, several chapters focus on several big moments. How did it feel trying to sum up all these massive moments? The 7-1 against Southampton, the European games, the FA Cup final, and the games running up to that. How did that feel like trying to document what must have been massive, massive nights and massive, massive games for lots of Watford fans who would pick this book up?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of went quite granular in the detail on some of those key events. I think there's an entire chapter dedicated to the 7-1 win against Southampton in the League Cup, where Watford had trailed 4-0 from the first leg. And obviously, you know, you lose the first leg 4-0, surely you're out of the cup. And this was a Southampton team that had, you know, Kevin Keegan in it and, you know, was a really top side. And Watford beat them 7-1. Similarly, the European games or the match against Wrexham, which finally clinched promotion, I kind of went into quite a lot of detail on those specific nights, so that we were sort of zooming in on some of the key events, some of the key matches, and getting, I hope, quite rich memories of what happened. I mean, one of the things that really sticks in my head about beating Wrexham to get promoted to the first division for the first time, it was a 2-0 win on a Tuesday night. And the thing that Graham Taylor remembered most about it was that the news had broken that HMS Sheffield had been sunk by the Argentinian forces in, you know, Britain was engaged in the Falklands War at the time. And the fact that Graham, all these years later, that was still the thing that kind of, you know, hand-in-glove memory with winning promotion to the first division, it just kind of put it into a broader context that this was a journey that they were all on, but it was part of their lives. It wasn't just sports results in the newspaper. You know, these were events where people said things, people remembered certain little moments about those games. And I suppose because I missed out on the European adventure, for example, the UEFA Cup run in autumn 83, I really wanted to get into the minds of the players and the coaches and the management about what those trips were like. And, you know, some of the most evocative sort of images are, I think, Neil Price talking about having their meal in a Sofia hotel in Bulgaria the night before the Levski Spartak match. And, you know, they basically they've got a sort of grey watery soup with an egg in it. And, you know, they're about to play a really big match in a very hostile ground in front of a huge crowd. And, you know, they're kind of eating, you know, for, bear in mind, this is behind the Iron Curtain in those days. So, you know, it was kind of austere. And so I kind of latched onto a few of those details about those key matches. The same with the FA Cup run and the final. You know, I really wanted to kind of slow everything down and kind of lay out, you know, just what that journey meant through those rounds. And then, of course, the sort of the build up to the final itself, which, you know, when you see it all set out, it was far from ideal, really. You know, it was just that one match too far for them, I think. And, you know, as a club, you know, Graham Taylor never said we were just happy to be there. But I think as a club, the achievement was in reaching Wembley and getting to the FA Cup final. And, you know, they just came up against a better side. But I think everybody felt, you know, having lost 2-0 to Everton, you know, the club had really achieved something by by getting to the final, and it was all about the journey rather than the destination, which is something, John, that we know all about from a few years ago, eh?
Too hard, yeah, too well. Because there are moments in that run that are, you know, you see Graham's genius, you see his commitment and values to how this would be achieved with what the players he had and the players he added. But he did have sort of certain, I think, two, sort of the way it comes across in the book, for him, two quite major mistakes that he made. One was in the preparation for the FA Cup final and naming the team the week before. And the other one is the FA Cup semi-final in 1987, where he didn't play Sherwood and he brought in someone who really wasn't ready to play in Plumlee. Do you think he looked back at those in the right way, in terms of, yes, they were mistakes, but they're, as you sort of say, they're part of the journey?
Yeah, I mean, two slightly separate things. The FA Cup final in 84, the whole team was unsettled, disrupted by the fact that Wilf Rostron had got sent off in a win at Kenilworth Road against Luton. I mean, Watford didn't win at Luton very often in those days, despite all the success. You know, Luton really were the bogey team a lot of the time. They won there 2-1. Wilf Rostron got sent off for a kind of something and nothing collision with Paul Elliott and a bit of a sort of scrap on the floor. It meant that Rostron was suspended for the FA Cup final. The club did kind of go through the motions of making an appeal for the FA to the FA, but I think they knew that they weren't going to get much joy. And Rostron was the captain and the left back. And it meant that Graham had a big decision to make about how to replace Rostron in the team. He went with Neil Price, who was the reserve left back, you know, perfectly acceptable decision. But in the process, you know, he'd been toying with asking Pat Rice, who was obviously very experienced but hadn't played pretty much all of the season. He hadn't played because he was getting on a bit and he'd actually started coaching. And there was this kind of uncertainty about how to plug the gap left by Wilf Rostron in order to settle down what was a very young team. I mean, I think at the time, and it may still be, the youngest ever back four to play in an FA Cup final. Leeson, it was 18. I think the oldest was Steve Terry, who was 21. In order to settle them all down, he named the team a week before, after the final league match of the season against Arsenal, which they'd won and won well. Midway through the week, Graham realised that he'd made a mistake and that he shouldn't have named it so early. Even if the team ended up being the same, he'd just made a mistake by... It had the opposite effect, I think, he felt, as the week wore on. Not that he wanted everybody on their toes thinking, oh, I might not make the team, but it just led to a sort of a slight feeling that there was, you know, the week was a formality and all they were waiting for was match day to arrive. I'm not sure it would necessarily have made much difference, but, you know, Graham dwelled on things that didn't go well for him. Because, you know, when you think about his whole career, there were very few real lows. I mean, obviously the lows that he did experience, especially the England job, you know, that was pretty spectacularly low. And he dwelt on that an awful lot more than any of the mistakes he made at Watford. But in that 10 years, yeah, you could count the mistakes he made on, he counted, or, you know, you could still count them on the fingers of one hand. The 87 semi-final was a slightly different situation. Tony Coton had broken his finger, the first-choice goalkeeper, a real blow because Coton was one of the best goalkeepers in the country. We were going to be facing Tottenham Hotspur, who were a good side, it has to be said, although I say that through gritted teeth.
Well, that was Clive Allen's big year, wasn't it?
They had this front five. He'd scored 49 goals in total that season. But they had Hoddle and Waddle and Nico Klassen and Paul Allen as well. And, you know, they were a top side, really. And so Watford were going to have to be at their very, very best to have any chance in the semi-final at Villa Park. Coton was injured. The understudy, Steve Sherwood, who, of course, had played in the FA Cup final in 84 and had taken quite a bit of the blame for the Andy Gray goal, even though I'll say until my final days that was a foul and it should have been a free kick. But Sherwood's, you know, had been replaced as the first-choice goalkeeper, was still the reserve team goalkeeper. But then he got an injury as well. And then in the run-up to the match, they were worried that Sherwood was not going to be fit enough. And this bizarre situation unfolded where they wanted to get a lone goalkeeper in. But, of course, any goalkeeper would either be signed on by another club and the transfer deadline had passed, as the system operated at the time, so they couldn't sign a goalkeeper. And anyone who was kind of a free agent, if you like, would have been cup-tied. They would have played in a FA Cup match. So the options were vanishingly few, except that Eddie Plumley, the chief executive of the club, and a very nice man he was, and at Watford through and through at the time, and in fact, you know, long after he left the club, you know, a really warm-hearted guy. His son, Gary Plumley, had been a pro goalkeeper. He'd played for Newport and I think Cardiff City. He'd famously played in the Cup Winners' Cup, the European Cup Winners' Cup for Newport. And he'd only recently hung up his boots and had started running. I mean, everyone says a wine bar. You know, he's a wine bar waiter. But, I mean, he owned this this kind of wine bar slash restaurant down in Newport. And Eddie said to Graham Taylor, well, my son would be eligible in an emergency, not thinking.
Or backup, wasn't it? Just for backup, wasn't it?
Not really thinking for a moment. Exactly, yeah. That his son would actually get to play in the match. So Gary Plumley was signed on, joined the team at their sort of mini training camp, was in Lillishall, which is not that far from Aston Villa, which is where the semi-final was going to be played. So he joined the team for a couple of days. And then nobody expected Graham to name Gary Plumley in the team, but he did. He felt that Steve Sherwood was not fit enough and was feeling his injury. Steve Sherwood said, till he was blue in the face, really, when I went to speak to him in Grimsby, when I interviewed him, he said I was fit. There was no reason not to play me. And that was the thing that, you know, hurt him most about his career. But Graham, in his wisdom, went for Gary Plumley. And of all the kind of little kind of side stories, or I mean, this is not a side story, it's a very significant story, really, because Watford lost the game 4-1. And frankly, Plumley was a weak link that Tottenham sought to exploit from the first minute. I mean, they were firing shots in from all over the place. And well before half time, Plumley was struggling. And he was asking John McClellan, the centre-back, to take the goal kicks for him. And so there was a, you know, it didn't work out well, whether Graham thought that the golden touch was going to see him out of trouble. I don't know, but it didn't work out. It's one of those things where there's almost conspiracies grew up about this whole thing. Some people said, oh, well, Graham didn't want to reach the FA Cup final because he'd already decided he was going to leave in the summer. I don't believe that to be true. Graham said that wasn't the case. Other people said, oh, you should have picked David James, who was the youth team goalkeeper. But David James, as talented as he was 16 years of age, and there was no way they were going to put him into a cup semi-final and have him potentially concede four goals. I mean, it's the sort of thing that could have wrecked a career. But that story, I never really felt satisfied that I... Not that I didn't trust Graham at all, because I don't know what the truth of it was. I suspect it was just a case that he wanted to spare Steve Sherwood any further sort of criticism, because Sherwood had really been affected by the negative coverage of his FA Cup final performance in 84. I mean, Graham did make that point, but I don't know whether that's enough of a reason. And I suppose my surprise was in going down to Newport and interviewing Gary Plumley and kind of expecting to, I guess, encounter a slightly humbler individual. What I found was somebody who, there was moments when he was almost convincing himself that he'd been picked for the FA Cup semi-final, you know, on merit, as if it was a footballing decision. That's a real puzzler for me, even now. I don't really know the truth of it, other than it was a very painful afternoon, losing 4-1 to Tottenham and missing out on a second cup final.
That was my first season being a Watford fan. It was a very painful time. My first ever pain that I felt. Many since, of course. So looking back now, you know, looking back on something you were looking back on, that's a weird thing to say, but, you know, on the book and on the time, do you look back at it any differently now? What is now, almost 13, 14 years later?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, the passage of time marches on, doesn't it? I mean, I started work on the book when it was around the 25th anniversary of the 1984 FA Cup final, as I said. And now, where are we? We're nearly 40 years away from that now. So I'm really glad that I did the book. I think it would be very different now. I think the book would be very different now that Graham's not around to contribute to it. I mean, I know that Elton John's version of the story is coming out, and if there's one kind of gap in my book, it's that I didn't get to speak to Elton John for a number of reasons. I mean, it got very close. Graham did sort of get close to setting up something, but it just didn't happen in time for my book. And in a sort of way, I kind of wanted Elton to sort of tell his story his way, which I gather is imminent. I think the book will be out. Elton's version of the story will be out in a month or so. And I kind of look back on it as, you know, it was the first book that I, the first long-form book that I wrote. I suspect I'd do it very differently now, but I'm really proud of it. I think that, and hearing Colin reading it, I mean, there were moments where it was really quite emotional. First of all, the sort of hairs on the back of my neck were standing up, and there were moments where the tears were starting to form, because it's an incredibly important period of time to me as a Watford supporter, a time when, you know, despite how great the recent years in the Premier League were, I felt anyway, you know, they never quite matched that childhood kind of sense of wonder that I had in the 80s when, you know, I didn't sort of fear Liverpool or Everton or Manchester United or Tottenham or Arsenal. I felt like we were total equals, and, you know, never quite felt that the second time round, even though we acquitted ourselves well. So I suppose the book itself and the story, and having the kind of the direct quotes from so many of the people that were the protagonists, the people who made it all happen. Yeah, it's a really nice thing. I feel it's a really nice thing that I was able to do. And my gratitude to all of the players who, when I contacted them, almost without exception, said yes, they'd be delighted to meet and share their memories. The one that was a little reluctant was my childhood hero, Maurice Johnston. I think because he'd had trouble with the press, because of the Rangers-Celtic thing, he viewed the media with a sense of suspicion. He did answer some questions by email, and we did have a brief chat on the phone, but I would love to have met Maurice and actually got his version of the events. But he's another one of those characters in the book who's larger than life simply because of the way other people talk about him.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
George Riley or Steve Harrison or Graham Taylor, that, yeah, talking about this incredibly talented but also slightly wayward young man who was, I mean, he was living the sort of the life of 10 men, I think, at that time.
At least trying to, by the stalk by what people talk about him, that's for sure. How many? I've got a copy of the book. I bought it back in 2010. How many copies were actually printed? Do you know?
Yeah, 2,500 I printed, and sold out. I never got round to doing a paperback because I felt like, anyone at the time who wanted to buy it had the opportunity to do so. I mean, you know, to put that in context, I mean, for sort of a relatively small football club book, that's actually pretty decent numbers. I do remember pitching it to a sort of fairly major publisher and getting a kind of, you know, a bit of a, no, I think, you know, if you could do the sort of Graham Taylor story, then yes, but, you know, Watford, not sure. But it was a very different time then. You know, back then, there wasn't kind of the BT Sport documentaries. I mean, I don't know, people would probably have seen them, but there's a fantastic Nottingham Forest documentary. There's a brilliant one about Wimbledon. That have been on BT Sport. And, you know, I feel like the Watford story is up alongside those as you know, the late 70s and 80s sort of English football fairy tales. And I guess, you know, my version is in print and those were TV documentaries. But I think that, if anything, it was maybe a little bit before its time. It was a little bit too early. Perhaps if I'd waited another 5 or 10 years... there might have been a bit more interest in it. But I didn't really do it for that. I did it because I wanted to do it and I wanted to go and, you know, have a coffee with Steve Sims and meet John McClelland and, you know, sort of sit down with Luther Blissett. For Watford fans of my vintage, I can say that was as wonderful as they would imagine it would be.
You already mentioned there about Colin reading it, because it's going to be a podcast. What made you want to bring it back to life, or not just go and do another couple of thousand prints of it. What do you, why do you want to turn it into this podcast?
Well, again, being a product of its era, I recorded every one of those interviews on a kind of a little USB dictaphone, just a digital dictaphone. And the audio quality of a lot of those interviews is not great because we were meeting in, as I said, Graham Taylor in the Belfry, and Steve Sims was in a Costa Coffee at Leicester Forest East Services, and Dave Bassett was in a hotel in Buckinghamshire, as I said. And, you know, pretty much all of these interviews were in public places. The notable exception was John Barnes was in a hotel room at the Wickham Holiday Inn or the Aylesbury Holiday Inn when he was manager of Tranmere, and they were playing Wickham Wanderers on a Tuesday night, and he said, "Oh, come along on, you know, Tuesday lunchtime," and he just wanted to not be in the public area of the hotel for some reason, so he sort of crouched in his bedroom. It was a bit awkward, really, but you know,
that's a whole other story. It is a whole other story.
You know, I was sort of perched on one side of the bed, he was perched on the other side of the bed, and
looking longingly into each other's eyes.
it was surreal, I have to say. And he was not having a terribly happy time as Tranmere manager at the time, and so, you know, I think his mind was perhaps on other things. I mean, it was a good interview and added plenty to the book, but yeah, so I had all this audio, as you know, John, but many other people might not know. I co-created the cycling podcast in 2013. And so podcasting has become my working life. I cover the Tour de France every year for the cycling podcast. And as you know, John, the recording equipment has become so much more sophisticated. And if I was to do it now, I would have kind of broadcast quality audio from all of these players. And my initial thought was, with the sort of the AI software that exists to clean up all these audio interviews and improve the quality of them, I did wonder whether it could be edited together into some kind of documentary sort of thing, maybe with me kind of bridging bits together. And when I pitched that idea to you, you kind of said, well, why don't you just do it as effectively a podcast series, but in the style of an audio book. And I know just the man to help you, Colin. Yes. Mace, who your listeners will know very well, another lifelong Watford fan. I have to say, a fantastic voice artist, and not just because of what he's done on this, but, you know, I mean, he is one of those people, if you listen to an audio book, the chances are you've heard his work. And
I think what I like about it most about it is the fact that, you know, firstly, he's so respective of the people whose voices they are. There are no impressions. The only impression he does is of Brian Clough, and that's fine, because everyone does an impression of Brian Clough. And they're only little short little bits, really. But he's so respectful, and you completely believe you're hearing those people. And listening to it, editing it up, and, you know, getting it all ready was just a joy to listen to him do what he does, and you're going to love it. And we're going to play chapter one in a minute for you. But it's going to be out as a podcast feed where you can listen to all 26 chapters. I think it's going to be a wonderful thing. I think lots of Watford fans, those who didn't, the 2,500 who didn't get a book, those who weren't part of the 2,500 didn't get a book, they will be able to sort of really enjoy this story and have Colin tell them the story.
Yeah, I mean, on that, we've really worked out totally in isolation on this. This has been a collaboration in the sense that we've all let each other get on with the bits that we do. Like, I mean, I wrote the book, obviously. My initial interest was to hear what Colin would do with it, rather than me saying, oh, I'd like it to be like this, or I'd like it to be like that. I didn't want to have that conversation with Colin at all, because I think that it's better than I could possibly have imagined it turning out. And I think if I had been involved in the process of trying to decide how it should sound, it wouldn't have sounded as good. You're absolutely right about the voices. Now, in my head, I know what all of the people sound like. Like you say, they're not impressions of the people, but they are Colin kind of inhabits the character of the people from the words that he's reading. So you get a sense of who Tom Whalley is through the words that he said to me in the interviews that I've written, and Colin kind of becoming a version of Tom Whalley. And, you know, there's, what, 40 odd characters in the book.
Yeah.
And to make it so that people can follow the story, what's going on, with all of those different voices, and then back into the voice of the narrator, i.e. me, and just, you know, the reading the bits in between. And there is a lot of kind of data in the book, isn't there? You know, yeah. It's kind of, you know, probably over rigorously researched, you know, all the dates and where we were in the league table and, you know, what the other results were around the match that I was writing about at the time. But Colin kind of slows it down when necessary, and then inhabits another character. And yeah, you're right, John, it is a fantastic listen. And if people have got the hours to just put it on in the car or on their headphones whenever they listen to their podcast, I mean, it's basically a Watford audiobook telling the story of what still remains the club's most extraordinary decade.
From the Rookend comes out on a Tuesday. Maybe Wednesday becomes the day you listen to another episode. Or if you really want to, you can listen to all 26 chapters all in one go, because we're going to put them all up on one go on a special feed. Of course, you can find links to that on our social medias and everywhere. And yeah, if you do find it, please share it with all Watford fans, because it is such a document, really, a documentation of a very important part of our history. And very worthwhile remembering, as the book sort of allows you to do. And maybe learn about it for the first time. I think there'll be a lot of fans who, you know, it's been 14 years. You know, if you were one, you're 14 years now. If you're 25, you're only 10 when the book came out. So it's important that, you know, there's lots of people I think will just adore listening to it. And you can take it at your own speed. It's not a race, however you like. I think the longest chapter is about an hour, and the shortest might be only about 15 minutes. So they do vary in length and stuff. But it's going to be brilliant. So here's his chapter one. It's called Elton's Dream. And this is what it's going to sound like when all the episodes are out there. So this is Enjoy the Game.
Enjoy the Game by Lionel Burney. Chapter one, Elton's Dream. Who could have known that a slip, a stumble, and a sloppy back pass by a Gillingham defender called David Galvin would have such a profound effect on the future fortunes of Watford Football Club? On a cold, drab November afternoon in 1976, as 4th Division Watford toiled against their 3rd Division opponents, time was ebbing away from the Hornets and their manager Mike Keane. There is no day like FA Cup first round day for reminding a club of its status. The glamour and potential glory of a third-round clash with one of the big boys is just a couple of steps away, but defeat means there will be no temporary reprieve from the humdrum of a lower division existence. The small band of Watford supporters who had travelled to Kent to see if their team could pull off a minor shock against a team that sat one division above them did so in the hope that they might be on course for a match against Liverpool or Manchester United. They needed some hope to cling to, because the league season certainly wasn't shaping up to much. As the clock ticked towards 20-5, a goalless draw and a replay at Vicarage Road looked inevitable. Mike Keane didn't know he needed one, but Galvin was about to throw him a lifeline. Earlier that day, Watford's directors, the chairman, Elton John, among them, had met for lunch at a hotel on their way to Priestfield for the match. They chewed over Keane's tenure and decided it was time for a change. If Watford did not knock Gillingham out of the cup that afternoon, Keane would be sacked on Monday morning. With less than a minute to go, Galvin fought clumsily to bring a poor pass under control near the touchline. Without looking, he half-turned and played it back to his goalkeeper, only to see a figure in yellow dart forward. The Gillingham fans realised the pass was going to fall woefully short. Alan Mays, Watford's lively forward, pounced, intercepting the ball before taking it round the keeper. 1-0. I always maintain that was one of the most important goals scored in Watford's history, says Muir Stratford, one of the directors who had pondered Keane's future that lunchtime. If we had not won that game, we would have sacked Mike Keane on the Monday. And if we had done that, there is absolutely no way Graham Taylor would have been manager of Watford Football Club. We simply wouldn't have got him in the middle of the season. Mike Keane was a pleasant, personable man, but he was neither ruthless nor single-minded enough to halt the decline. One problem for the manager was that the most successful era in the club's history was still a recent memory. With Ken Furphy at the helm, the club had been promoted to the second division and reached an FA Cup semi-final as the 60s gave way to the 70s, only for the lack of vision from a risk-averse chairman, Jim Bonzer, causing it all to unravel. After clambering up the ladder to those unprecedented heights, Watford had slipped right back to where they had started. Keane had presided over relegation to the fourth division and had been unable to galvanise the team for an instant return. Crowds had dwindled to a hard core of 5,000 or so, and Bonzer, who had owned the club since the late 50s, seemed paralysed, unable to either stump up or sell up. Even as Furphy led the rise to the second division, Bonzer had been frugal. He was a self-made man from Preston who had earned his money building up his construction firm from scratch. But he failed to recognise the need to invest, seeing the big step to the first division as unrealistic for a club like Watford, and resenting the idea of spending money to stand still if the same result could be achieved more cheaply. Bonzer was also reluctant to welcome onto the board others who were prepared to add to the coffers. In the late 60s, a wealthy businessman called Dennis Mortimer had offered to put in a significant sum, but Bonzer feared it would dilute his control. Furphy finally realised the chairman was never going to loosen his grip on the purse strings and joined Blackburn Rovers. Mortimer took his money up the road to Luton Town and helped fund an era of success for the Hatters, and the Hornets slipped back down the divisions. "To get on with Bonzer, you had to be a yes man," says Stratford, who joined Watford's board in 1971. It wasn't unusual for people not to get on with him. No one could ever doubt his commitment to the club, but it was basically a one-man show. He had come to the club when it was in desperate straits, and he'd ensured its survival, but he was a difficult man to get on with. He wanted his way, and he didn't want other people to have any power or influence. Initially, Bonzer had been cautious about letting the flamboyant rock star Elton Hercules John join the board. Elton had neither a name nor an image that appealed to Bonzer, but Elton had money. And he had something even more valuable, something Bonzer could not claim. He had been a Watford supporter since childhood, when he was just little Reg Dwight, a boy who liked to stand on the crumbling old terrace between the Rookery and the Schrodale stand known as The Bend. He had seen the shirt change from blue to gold, and the team transform from the Brewers to the Hornets. The contrast between Bonzer and Elton could not have been starker. Bonzer had an uneasy relationship with supporters and was not loved. Elton was a supporter. He'd carried the Hornets in his heart since childhood, had dreamt of playing for the team, and was now in a position to help the club off the pitch. Finally, in 1976, Bonzer was persuaded to sell his share of the club to Elton, who was now a vice president. The deal was done just as he was preparing for a lengthy tour of the United States, named, with typical understatement, the Louder Than Concord Tour. It was a strange marriage. The rock superstar with a dress sense as loud as his backing band, and the fourth division football club with a tumble-down home and a stack of debts. But Elton saw beyond Bonzer's limited horizons. His passion, vision and wealth was obvious. While those outside the club may not have taken him seriously, and some wrote him off as a rich kid looking for a new toy to play with, around the boardroom table they took him seriously. His intentions were clear. He just didn't quite know at the outset how to achieve them. "From day one he was totally flamboyant and larger than life," says Stratford, "but his interest in the football was complete. He made no bones about it. He didn't really know how things worked, but he wanted to find out, and he wanted to make the club a success." Treading water, unable to string the wins together, and worse than that, not particularly easy on the eye, Watford had the look of a side resigned to another year in the basement after only 15 league games of the 1976-77 season. Victory over Gillingham in the FA Cup replay spared Keane temporarily, but Elton and the other directors had merely postponed their decision. Elton had money to invest, but collectively, the board didn't feel Keane should be the one to spend it. That glamorous third-round tie didn't materialise either. Watford were dumped out of the cup in the second round by non-league Northwich Victoria, which surely would have been grounds for sacking the manager had the directors not decided to wait. It wasn't until April 1977, with another season in the fourth division of certainty, that Keane was finally dismissed. With a multi-millionaire at the helm, expectations had risen to match the chairman's profile. In 1976, Terry Challis, the cartoonist at the Watford Observer, completed his allegorical painting that depicted with astonishing prescience the journey ahead. In it, a Watford player is taking his first tentative step out of the lower division wastelands as Elton, sitting astride a hornet, points towards the promised land, which is represented by the liverbird atop a distant mountain. The path ahead was clear. Now the search was on for a manager capable of matching Elton's considerable ambition.
In terms of attacking the man, you're getting somebody to close him down, and then your other fellow that's coming is coming in there to support and make the angle. But we want to do that at the same time. We don't want to see any ball sit in any of the opposition. I don't want to see the ball still. If it's one touch, we play it off one. If it's two touch, it's controlled, and then it's played away again.
Graham Taylor of 3rd Division, Lincoln City, was established as a promising young manager by 1977, and one or two bigger clubs had already considered him, but some wondered if he was ready to step up just yet. He was still only 32, and most clubs had at least a couple of players older than that. Heneage Dove, the Lincoln chairman, handed Taylor his break in management in December 1972. "I was 28 years old," says Taylor. "One day I was one of 24 players. The next day I was the manager of 23. Dove's faith was tested right from the start. Taylor's first 11 games as a football manager brought 7 draws and 4 defeats. There was not outright rebellion on the terraces of Sinsel Bank, but people were asking questions, and there was the odd shout of Taylor out. It would have been easy for Dove to sack him, after all. Who would kick up a fuss over the dismissal of a 28-year-old promoted to the role too soon? But Dove believed in his young protégé and stuck with him. John Ward witnessed what was at times an awkward transition from player to manager. A couple of years earlier, Ward had arrived at Lincoln as a teenage centre-forward. On his first day, he was shown into the dressing room and given the peg next to the team captain, Taylor. A firm friendship that has lasted 4 decades was born. "Graham was always destined to be a manager," says Ward. "He'd qualified as a coach very young, before he was 20, and if it's possible to map out a life in this game, he had done it. There were murmurings of discontent during those 11 games, and some people thought it was a mistake putting a young person in charge, but Heneage Dove wanted to stick by his man. He was a lovely guy, and a very straight-laced gentleman, and he'd given the job to Graham because he felt he could do it, so he wasn't going to get rid of him rashly." The way Taylor turned things around was simple. He worked hard. "We spent hours and hours on the training ground," says Ward. "Graham was very thorough, and we became well organised." A sense of authority did not come immediately, and Taylor did not lay down the law at first. He had to earn the respect of men who, a few weeks earlier, had been his peers, his mates, and slowly they accepted him as the boss. He had some authority in leadership because he was the team captain, and they respected him for that. But he did it gently, because he had to, says Ward. He let things evolve, and the way he earned their respect was not by insisting he was the boss, but by taking responsibility for the team. He was a very likeable person, and he won people over. In 1976, the Imps ran away with the 4th Division Championship, scoring 111 goals and setting a record points total by playing with a pace and verve that is still spoken of in reverential terms in Lincolnshire. The team was built on values that would become synonymous with Graham Taylor, a ferocious work ethic allied to an attacking instinct and a desire to entertain. During their charge towards the title, Lincoln demolished Watford 3-1 at Vicarage Road and 5-1 at Sinsel Bank. Two of Watford's directors, Stratford and Jeff Smith, were particularly struck by the style of play, the controlled aggression and the eagerness with which Lincoln's players sought to shoot at goal. They wanted to know more about the man who had crafted such a side. "We had this little corner of the boardroom, a sort of ante-room, where only the directors would go," says Stratford. "We used to call it the Kremlin, and it was where we'd go if we wanted a quiet word away from the other guests in the boardroom. After every match, we'd invite the opposition manager in for a drink." Stratford was bowled over by Taylor's enthusiasm and confidence. "You don't have to spend very long with people to get a feel for them, and I think both Jeff and I were immediately impressed." Taylor talked more than the directors, which was unusual for a visiting manager, and as he spoke, the ideas seemed to tumble from him with a passion that was infectious. He talked quickly but with clarity, shifting his weight from foot to foot as he held the attention of those around him. The opposition manager was demonstrating more energy, imagination and inspiration over a post-match drink than many of Watford's own players had mustered out on the pitch. It was evident to Stratford that Taylor was going places, even if Lincoln City would eventually prove unable to provide the finances to keep pace with his ambition. Dove had great faith in his manager, but knew his club lacked the money to complete the journey Taylor had set out on. By March 1977, Lincoln had consolidated their position in the third division, and Taylor's name was on the shortlist whenever another job came up. Dove was a shrewd operator. He knew he'd lose Taylor eventually, but when he did, he wanted Lincoln to get something out of it, so he offered an improved contract with an important clause. If Taylor left for another club, they'd have to pay Lincoln £20,000 in compensation. Lincoln had only ever sold one player for more money, a striker called Andy Graver, which indicated the value Dove placed on his manager. When Elton got home from his tour, he headed to the studio to record an album, meaning he would now have plenty of time for his football club. Elton was not interested in kicking around in the fourth division any longer, and he knew he needed to do something to kickstart a revolution. The appointment of a new manager would be his first major decision as chairman, and he wanted it to be a statement of intent, something to inspire the supporters, grab the attention of the hacks on Fleet Street, and help attract the players Watford would need to drag them out of the bottom division. Who could be better than Bobby Moore?
Bobby Moore led England up to the Royal Box to receive the Jules Rimet Cup and the winners' medals.
The only Englishman to have lifted the Jules Rimet trophy. Bringing a World Cup winning captain to Vicarage Road would put the club on the map straight away. Moore was 36 and about to call time on his playing career at Fulham. He was part of English football's heritage. Everyone remembered the July afternoon 11 years earlier when he held the trophy aloft at Wembley. But Stratford and Smith were far from starstruck. They felt Watford needed someone with a detailed knowledge of the lower divisions. They didn't want someone dour or down-to-earth for the sake of it. And it wasn't that they didn't share Elton's ambition. It's just they wanted someone who knew what lower division was all about. When the board first drew up a shortlist, Taylor's name failed to make much of an impression with the chairman. "Elton, I have to say, had never heard of Graham Taylor," says Stratford. There was nothing terribly surprising with that. Nothing wrong with it either, but Jeff and I had been to all these lower division grounds for a number of years, and we knew the managers. Elton didn't. To Elton's credit, he was not rash or bull-headed. He sought advice. He asked the England manager, Don Revie, who he should appoint. Revie was unequivocal. "Graham Taylor at Lincoln City. He's the man you want." One day in April 1977, Graham Taylor's phone rang. It was Don Revie, and Taylor instantly recognised the voice and instinctively straightened himself up in his chair. He had met Revie before when the England manager gave a talk at a coaching course at the Lincoln and District Football Association, but to receive a call at home, this must be important. Revie got straight to the point. "Are you under contract?" he asked. Taylor explained that he'd only recently signed an extension with Lincoln. "That's a shame, because I've just recommended you to a chairman." "Oh, yes, who's that?" asked Taylor. "It's Elton John." Silence. "At Watford." More silence. Taylor's ego was punctured. "At that moment, my feelings for Don Revie sank," he says. Was this how little he thought of me? Lincoln were in the third division. Watford were in the fourth. Why on earth would Don Revie think I'd want to go there? And I have to be honest, I thought, who is Elton John anyway? In one brief phone call, Taylor's self-image had been inflated and then deflated. It wasn't that he was expecting his next move to be to Anfield or Highbury, but to have the England manager recommend him for, where was it? Vicarage Road. How disappointing. The newspapers had already mentioned Taylor's name in much more prestigious company. But more than that, why would he want to drop back to the fourth division when it had taken him the best part of 4 years to get Lincoln out of there in the first place? Watford didn't have any history to speak of, just a pop star chairman, whose music wasn't particularly to Taylor's taste anyway. A fortnight later, Elton rang Taylor himself, and although Taylor did him the courtesy of listening to what he had to say, was no keener on the idea. So Elton went back to his first choice, Bobby Moore. They met for lunch at the Howard Hotel in London's Temple Place. The rock star and the World Cup winner got on well. Moore was looking for his first break in football management. Elton was seeking a high-profile figure to add status and prestige to the club before propelling the team through the divisions. As they shook hands at the end of their meeting, Moore believed it was a done deal. All that remained was for Elton to call to finalise the details. The following day, Jeff Powell, a journalist with the Daily Mail and a close contact and friend of Moore's, ran the story. Moore would be the next manager at Watford, it said in black and white. The first Stratford knew of it was when he picked up the paper. "I was straight on the phone to Jeff Smith, and we were on to Elton pretty quickly," he says. Relieved that nothing had been signed, Stratford and Smith made their case to Elton. "It wasn't that I objected to Moore on any personal level. I just couldn't see him being the right type of manager for Watford at the time. Could you see Bobby Moore standing on the terraces scouting a player or watching the reserves?" Elton listened to his directors. The strength with which they stated the case for Graham Taylor, combined with the fact that they were pitching in favour of the same man Revy had recommended, won him over. "I think he thought it was a happy coincidence that we were of the same opinion as the England manager," says Stratford. "Perhaps he thought maybe these two do know what they're talking about after all." Elton still didn't know an awful lot about Graham Taylor, other than the record-breaking 4th Division Championship success he'd had at Lincoln. But if he could produce something similar for him at Watford, it would certainly get the ball rolling. The life of a football manager in the late 70s was not so far removed from that of the ordinary man on the terraces as it is today. They had a bit more money, perhaps, but they were not living on a different planet. In the early summer of 1977, the Taylor family went on their first overseas holiday, caravanning in France. With his wife, Rita, and two young children, Joanne and Karen, in the car, Taylor was keen to get home in a hurry. "I was driving as fast as I could, because I wanted to get home to watch the England versus Scotland game on television," he says. As soon as the final whistle went, the phone rang. It was Elton, who had also been watching the game and had waited for it to finish before calling. "I know you said you weren't interested, but I won't feel I'm doing my job properly unless I meet you and explain what it is we want to do. I can't just say to my directors, 'Oh, I rang him, he said no, and that's the end of it,'" Elton said. Taylor said Elton would have to ask Lincoln's permission first, and so it wasn't until a week later that he travelled south, staying overnight in a hotel in Slough before heading to Elton's home in Windsor the next morning. For a man who had just been on his first foreign family holiday, the rock star's home was an eye-opener, with its expensive furniture and artwork on the walls. Elton wasted little time in making an offer. "It was like entering a different world," says Taylor. "Here he was offering me a 5-year contract worth 4.5 times the money I was on at Lincoln. I have to be honest, at the time the money was a factor, of course it was." Taylor explained the business about Heneage Dove's £20,000 release clause. Elton didn't bat an eyelid. Taylor's solicitor had told him it would have been easy to argue the clause with a restraint of trade, but the way he saw it, if someone was prepared to pay Lincoln the money, why shouldn't they be compensated? Taylor asked Elton what he expected in return for a salary that would almost certainly make him the best-paid manager outside the First Division and better paid than some in the top flight. This was a Watford team that had spent only 3 years in the Second Division and all of the rest of its time in the lower divisions. "So I was expecting Elton to say that he wanted me to get them back to the Second Division," says Taylor. Instead, Elton replied, "I'd like to get into Europe." Europe? With the likes of Milan and Real Madrid. That would mean finishing among the top half dozen in the First Division or winning the FA Cup. Watford had just finished 7th in the 4th Division, or, to put it another way, 75th out of 92. "I thought to myself, this fellow's is crazy. He's a pop star. He's clearly got a lot of money, but he's living in the clouds." Taylor tried to bring Elton back down to earth. "I asked him what he thought it would cost to do that. He said he didn't know and threw the same question back at me. I thought, well, I'd better really frighten him here. 'I don't think you'll have any change out of £1 million,' Taylor told Elton. "Right," came the reply. "We'll give it a go." For a moment, Taylor paused, and he looked across at Elton John. This pop star, who had £1 million to blow on an unfashionable 4th Division club that had never finished higher than 18th in the 2nd Division. It almost seemed like an elaborate hoax, but there was a steely look in Elton's eyes. "Well, that'll do for me," Taylor thought. Later that day, Taylor travelled to London for one of the big events of the year, the Football League's annual general meeting at the Café Royal. What Elton John didn't know was that Watford was not the only club to have approached Taylor. First Division West Bromwich Albion had just sacked Johnny Giles and contacted Taylor through a third party rather than seeking Lincoln's permission. After the meal, Taylor was beckoned over to West Brom's table where their directors sat, well-fed, surrounded by the cigar butts and brandy glasses that follow an agreeable lunch. The offer they had made Taylor was a fair bit less than Elton's, but the chance to leap straight into the First Division appealed. West Brom's chairman was Bert Millerchip, who was later to become chairman of the Football Association. He was also aware of the £20,000 release clause in Taylor's contract, and as a solicitor, knew it would not stand up to much of a challenge. "Well," Millerchip told Taylor, "we'll agree to it, but we'll offer to pay it in instalments. We'll pay them £5,000 up front, but we won't pay them any more after that." Taylor was immediately turned off. I thought, how can they be saying this? I just didn't like their approach. Then Millerchip told Taylor, "You haven't played in the First Division, coached in the First Division, or managed in the First Division, but we're prepared to take a risk on you." Albion's offer was a little more than half the one Elton had put on the table, and it came without the security of a contract, meaning that if things didn't work out, he could be sacked without compensation. Taylor told the West Bromwich directors he had spoken to another club, not just because he wanted to strengthen his hand, but to be up front with them. "Do you mind telling us who it is?" asked one of the other directors. "It's Watford." "Watford? In the Fourth Division?" came the incredulous response. It was pretty much the same reaction as Taylor's when Revy called him, but now it put his back up. Then came something that really grated. "But you'll be going to places like Halifax and Workington," said one of the directors through a puff of cigar smoke. "Excuse me," said Taylor, distinctly unimpressed. "Workington haven't been voted back into the league. At your meeting this afternoon, you all voted and Workington didn't get re-elected to the Football League. And you don't even know that." The attitude of the West Bromwich directors, their ignorance and the lack of respect they had showed for life in the lower divisions, annoyed Taylor and made up his mind. He joined Watford. Lincoln got their £20,000, and the phone call Bobby Moore was awaiting never came. Elton felt bad about that, and although he didn't tell the other directors, he made a significant payment to Moore out of his own pocket as an apology for the way things had turned out. It's fair to say Graham Taylor's appointment did not spark a rash of celebratory street parties in Watford. For those who had read the Daily Mail story and felt the frisson of excitement at the imminent arrival of the England World Cup winning captain, there was a sense of disappointment. Taylor's salary, reported to be around £25,000 a year, created shockwaves. A cartoon by Terry Challis in the Watford Observer depicted one supporter saying to another, "When I read the terms, I thought they'd signed Elizabeth Taylor," referring to the Hollywood star, reportedly the best-paid actor in the world at one time. But Taylor was not just a football manager. The job was not simply to revitalise a flagging football team, but to invigorate a club and an entire town. Taylor's title was general manager, and Elton told him, "You're in charge from the top down," which is just how Taylor wanted it. What Taylor inherited was a shambles. There was no training ground, so they trained on public playing fields in Horseshoe Lane, Garston. There were barely any facilities at the stadium either. When Eddie Plumley arrived as secretary and chief executive a little while after Taylor, he described it as a corrugated graveyard, and the training kit was full of holes. One of Taylor's first divisions was to evict the local Greyhound Association. They held regular race meetings on the cinder track surrounding the pitch, but seemed to have more rights over the use of the ground than the football club. When he arrived, the club was negotiating a new three-year deal which would have brought in £10,000. But Taylor told Elton, "It's either the dogs or me. Are we running a football club or a greyhound track?" The club's finances were in a mess, and the secretary, Ron Rollitt, was fretting because the overdraft had been extended again from £80,000 to £90,000. Elton wiped the slate clean and handed Taylor £20,000 to buy a player or two. More experienced than he had been when he first took over at Lincoln, Taylor was full of confidence and determined to hit the ground running. The priority was to get out of the Fourth Division at the first attempt. The supporters had no idea Elton had told Taylor the target was to reach the First Division and play in Europe, so there wasn't any great sense of external pressure from the supporters. Crowds were small. Expectations were low. Most of the club's supporters would have considered the Third Division to be the club's natural level, with the hope of a season or two in the Second Division a bonus. Anything more than that seemed like a distant dream. But Taylor says, "The pressure was actually on to deliver some results in one sense because Elton was spending money and I didn't want to waste it. Having said that, I didn't feel any pressure on myself because I was being allowed to do what I wanted to do. I was calling the shots, so there wasn't anyone holding me back or limiting me in what I wanted to do. There wasn't anyone to blame if something went wrong because I was running the show, and as a manager, that is the ideal situation to be in. The responsibility for results is yours, but you have the freedom to make the decisions you think are best for the team and the club." The first job was to have a look at the players he had inherited and work out which ones were willing and able to take up the challenge he was about to lay down and which ones he would have to ease towards the exit door. As he rolled up his sleeves to start work, the players had already picked up on the vibe. There were going to be some big changes around the place. End of chapter one. Next time, the Watford players have a wake-up call and realise they are going to work harder than they've ever worked before.
What do you think, Lana, is going to be the chapter that people are going to enjoy the most? Is it going to be one of the big ones, or is it just purely the chapter? I mean, one of my favourites, I think, was the Tom Whalley chapter.
I think those ones where we break out of the story and talk about the characters, Tom Whalley, Nigel Callahan.
Yeah.
I think the story of discovering John Barnes and trying to unpick the kind of the myth from the truth, because there's so many versions of that story, and it's another one of those ones where, you know, what really was the truth of it? Because all that really matters is that Watford ended up signing a fantastic player. But just again, you know, I listened to it in order. But I did. There were sections that I was really keen to just hear what Colin had done with them. And Steve Harrison telling the story of John Barnes turning up for his first Watford reserve game. Again, in my mind's eye, I'm in the dressing room at Vicarage Road in 1981. And, you know, I can sort of see, I don't know, whoever would have been in that team sort of sat around in just their shorts and socks, you know, yet to put their shirt and boots on. And it was things like that Colin has really brought to life. Because it's all very well writing these stories. And I tried, as, you know, the pace of the book does kind of go quick, slow. And the way he has, as I say, made those real kind of three-dimensional, immersive kind of passages. That's the bits that I enjoyed most anyway.
Yeah, so hopefully you enjoy it. And it's been, fantastic for me to help make it and turn it into what it is. I know Colin has enjoyed reading it as well. And I hope you all enjoy, looking back on a very important time.
I'd just like to say thanks to you, John, for planting the seed, really, because I wouldn't have put it out in this format had it not been for your suggestion. And as I mean, I've said, you know, a lot about Colin's acting, really, isn't it? I mean, he is a voice artist, you know, by profession, and that is a real privilege to hear my work, because these days, I mean, I've done the odd audiobook of my own stuff in cycling, and they make you read it yourself now. So having somebody else read it is a real luxury, and Colin's done a fantastic job, and I couldn't be more grateful to him for the love that he's put into it, really.
Yeah. So going down, go and find episode number 2. It'll be out tomorrow. This is Thursday. If it's Friday or even beyond that for you, then it's out already, and you can sit and listen to the other 25 chapters. But you can listen to chapter 1 as well, again, if you want to. So thank you very much for your time, Lionel.
Thank you very much, John.
And everybody, enjoy the game, the podcast.